Part 2. Benefits. Chapter 4. Our unnaturally livable fossil-fueled world. The full benefits of continuing fossil fuel use. In Part 1, I demonstrated that the mainstream knowledge system we rely on to help us evaluate what to do about the crucial issue of fossil fuels, the system that is telling us that the experts say we must rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use, cannot be trusted because it is operating on the anti-human, anti-energy, anti-impact framework. To know what to do about the crucial issue of fossil fuels, we need a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use, its full benefits and side effects, that synthesizes the best expert research using the human flourishing framework, including the goal of advancing human flourishing, not eliminating human impact, and the wild potential view of Earth, not the delicate nurturer view. This is what I will be doing my best to give you in the rest of this book. In chapters 4 through 6, I will cover the full benefits of continuing fossil fuel use. In chapters 7 through 9, I will cover the full negative side effects of continuing fossil fuel use. I am starting with the full benefits because, as we saw in Chapter 2, fossil fuel use affects how significant its negative side effects are, because its benefits can often be used to neutralize and overwhelm its negative side effects. For example, we saw that even if fossil fuels' contribution to warming thus far has had negative consequences, the energy we get from fossil fuels also has significant climate mastery benefits, such as powering irrigation systems and drought relief convoys that have reduced climate-related disaster deaths to all-time lows. And we saw that whatever fossil fuels' contribution to water pollution, its ability to purify dirty water and pump it far and wide has contributed to clean water being more accessible than ever. I will divide my explanation of the benefits of continuing fossil fuel use into three chapters, answering two basic questions. The first question, which I will answer in this chapter, is, what are the full, current benefits of the world's massive use of fossil fuels? As we have seen, our knowledge system is constantly ignoring these benefits. Benefits that I will demonstrate are far, far greater than I have indicated so far. The second question, which I will answer in chapters 5 and 6, is, what is the comparative future ability of fossil fuels and alternatives to provide the benefits the world currently gets from fossil fuels, both for those who are empowered by cost-effective energy and, crucially, for the billions who aspire to become empowered? As we have seen, our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system has almost zero interest in the need of billions of people for cost-effective energy and constantly distorts the actual ability of alternatives to do what fossil fuels do. Our knowledge system's trivialization of cost-effective energy. I am devoting this chapter to explaining the full current benefits of the ultra-cost-effective, low-cost, on-demand, versatile, global-scale energy fossil fuels provide us for two reasons. One, those benefits are far, far greater than I have been able to explain so far. Two, our knowledge system utterly trivializes the benefits of cost-effective energy in general and of fossil fuels in particular to the point that we are overwhelmingly blinded to these benefits. As I discussed in Chapter 1, part of the way our knowledge system deprives us of an understanding of the current benefits of fossil fuels is by denying the unique cost-effectiveness of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels alone provide ultra-cost-effective energy, low-cost, on-demand, versatile, on a scale of billions of people in thousands of places. And yet our knowledge system portrays fossil fuels as one source of energy among many and on their way out, even though they are 80% of the world's energy use and their use continues to grow. As bad as the denial of fossil fuels' unique cost effectiveness is, an even worse failure of our knowledge system is its utter trivialization of the benefits of cost-effective energy as such, and of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy in particular. It is this failure that I want to address and redress in this chapter. To understand the benefits of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy, or anything else, to human flourishing around the world, we need to understand, one, what is the current state of human flourishing around the world, and two, what is the role of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy, or anything else, in the current state of human flourishing. For example, to understand the benefits of vaccines or antibiotics to the state of our world, we must understand that, one, human beings today are far safer than they have ever been from infectious diseases, and that, two, vaccines and antibiotics have each played an essential role. If we believed that the world today is no safer from infectious diseases than it used to be, we could not possibly understand the benefits of vaccines or antibiotics. And if we believe that the world is safer, but that factors other than vaccines and antibiotics did all the work, then we cannot understand the benefits of vaccines and antibiotics. While our knowledge system leaves much to be desired in its treatment of vaccines and antibiotics, most people have the sense that we are generally safer from infectious diseases than previous generations, and that vaccines and antibiotics have at least played an important role. But on the issue of ultra-cost-effective energy from fossil fuels, our knowledge system has failed so completely to explain the state of human flourishing and fossil fuels' role in it that many highly educated people believe that human flourishing is on the decline and that cost-effective energy from fossil fuels is the primary cause of that decline. Consider a recent survey of college-educated individuals in the UK. The survey asked, in the last 30 years, the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has, the possible answers were, decreased, remained more or less the same, and increased. Extreme poverty was defined as living on less than $2 a day in today's dollars. The actual answer to this question, as I mentioned in Chapter 2, is that the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has been decreasing at a wonderful and unprecedented rate. In the last 30 years, it has decreased from 35% in 1990 to less than 10% today. And yet, what did the college-educated respondents answer? Only 12% answered decreased. 33% said it has remained more or less the same. And 55% responded that extreme poverty has increased in the last 30 years. These college-educated adults are 180 degrees wrong about the state of poverty in our world. That's how badly the knowledge system has failed at communicating the state of human flourishing. People who have no idea how good the state of human flourishing is today cannot possibly understand the role of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy in today's state of human flourishing. Instead, what they understand is the alleged role of fossil fuels in the supposed decline in human flourishing. While the survey did not ask what respondents attributed the non-existent increase in extreme poverty to, it's pretty easy to guess they would believe fossil fuels play a major role. After all, the same knowledge system that communicates that the world is getting worse is communicating that catastrophic climate change, pollution, and resource depletion caused by fossil fuels are huge drivers of life getting worse and worse. In reality, as I indicated in Chapter 1, ultra-cost-effective energy from fossil fuels, powering productivity-amplifying and expanding machines, clearly played an important role in the miraculous alleviation of poverty. The fact that, during the most miraculous decline of extreme poverty in human history, contributed to by ultra-cost-effective energy from fossil fuels, college-educated adults can think the rate of extreme poverty is getting worse due to fossil fuels shows just how completely our knowledge system trivializes the benefits of fossil fuels and of cost-effective energy as such. While not everyone is so ignorant of the value of cost-effective energy, I submit that even the vast majority of people who ascribe value to cost-effective energy don't think of it as all that valuable, as evidenced by the fact that almost no one seems to care about the billions of people using very little energy, and almost no one is afraid of what will happen if government projects to rapidly replace fossil fuels with mostly solar and wind don't work out. Certainly, most people who ascribe value to cost-effective energy put those benefits in a far lesser category of importance than the negative side effects of fossil fuels. The negative side effects of fossil fuels, we are told, especially rising CO2 levels, are harming the very livability of the planet and threaten it far more in the future. When the livability of the planet is at stake, who cares if we make energy a little bit more expensive or even quite a bit more expensive? The view that the cost-effectiveness of energy is in a totally different and less important category than the livability of the planet was memorably captured by rising politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who famously said in 2019, "Millennials and Gen Z and all these folks that come after us are looking up and we're like, the world will end in 12 years if we don't address climate change, and your biggest issue is, how are we going to pay for it?" But, as I will explain in the rest of this chapter, if we think about the livability of the planet from a proper human flourishing perspective, we find out that ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy is not irrelevant to the livability of the planet for human beings. It is actually fundamental to it. Only once we have this true understanding of fossil fuels' fundamentality to the livability of the planet, an understanding I submit that 99.9% of people, including the vast majority of energy and climate experts, lack, can we possibly make informed decisions about what to do about fossil fuel CO2 emissions and other side effects that allegedly threaten the livability of the planet. What is a livable planet? Because this book's moral goal and standard is advancing human flourishing, nothing could be of more importance than something that affects the livability of the planet. Thus, in part 3, I will thoroughly investigate claims that continuing CO2 emissions from continuing fossil fuel use will drastically harm the livability of the planet. However, because my moral goal and standard is advancing human flourishing, I think of the livability of the planet far differently than our anti-impact knowledge system does and teaches us to in two major ways. One, I look at the livability of the planet from a human flourishing perspective. Two, I am open to ways in which fossil fuels profoundly benefit the livability of the planet. Looking at the livability of the planet from a human flourishing perspective. Livable planet, in its common usage, is an example of the vague, confusing environmental terminology I discussed in the previous chapter, because it packages together two very different things. One, a planet that is highly livable for human beings, and two, an unimpacted planet that is allegedly more livable for all species. This is nonsense, as many, many species are far better off with humans than without them. As I discussed at the end of the previous chapter, as someone who wants a planet that is highly livable for human beings, which means a highly impacted planet, I like to avoid confusion by referring to a livable world or the livability of our world, which captures that we're thinking of the planet and everything on it in relation to human flourishing. For the same reason, when I'm talking about some particular environment, I like to refer to the livability of our environment. What exactly is the livability of our world, or any environment within our world? It is its conduciveness to human flourishing. The easier an environment makes it for the average human being to flourish, the more livable it is. I divide the livability of our world, or any of its sub-environments, into three basic aspects. 1. How nourishing it is. Meaning, what quantity and quality of food and water can a typical individual acquire with a given amount of time and effort? A non-nourishing environment is one in which one toils for hours and hours a day to acquire barely enough food and water to make it to the next day, and that food and water is of low quality, maybe even carrying disease. A highly nourishing environment is one in which, in a relatively small amount of time, one can acquire plenty of healthy, tasty food and clean drinking water. 2. How safe it is. How low a threat of death and damage from one's environment a typical individual can achieve with a given amount of time and effort. A very unsafe environment is one in which a large percentage of the individual's time is consumed trying to protect themselves from death and damage, and yet they are still at a high risk of death or damage. A very safe environment is one in which, in a relatively small amount of time, individuals can achieve a very low threat of death and damage from their surroundings. 3. How opportunity-filled it is. How much opportunity for fulfillment the typical individual has. Opportunity for fulfillment comes down to 3 issues. How much time individuals have on Earth, how much control individuals have over that time, and how fulfilling individuals' options are for how to spend that time. An environment with little opportunity for fulfillment is one in which it is difficult for individuals to live a long time, difficult for individuals to choose what to do with their time, and in which individuals have few fulfilling options to spend their time on. An environment with a lot of opportunity for fulfillment is one in which it is relatively easy for individuals to live a long time, relatively easy for individuals to choose what to do with their time, and in which individuals have many potentially fulfilling options to spend their time on. Being open to ways in which fossil fuels profoundly benefit the livability of the planet. Once we look at the livability of the planet from a human flourishing perspective as the livability of our world, how conducive it is to human flourishing, we are completely open to the evidence that fossil fuels profoundly benefit the livability of our world by making it a more nourishing, safe, and opportunity-filled place to live. And once we look at the livability of our world and are open to fossil fuels' benefits to it, we discover that our knowledge system's narrative about fossil fuels and livability is exactly backward. Fossil fuel energy's side effects haven't made Earth unnaturally unlivable. Fossil fuel energy's benefits have made Earth unnaturally livable. The hydrocarbons and human flourishing hockey sticks. To understand the state of the world's livability and fossil fuels' role in it, we need metrics of livability. While there are no perfect metrics of the world's livability from a human flourishing perspective, 3 excellent ones are average life expectancy, average income, and total population. Average life expectancy. The average number of years a human being lives is an excellent measure of the world's livability. When it is low, it means that the world is a place in which the average human being must spend an enormous amount of effort to stay nourished and safe, with a high rate of failure. When it is high, it means that human beings' efforts enable them to stay nourished and safe with a high rate of success, and it means that humans have more time on Earth in which they can pursue fulfillment. Average income, which captures the amount of resources at the average human's disposal, is also an excellent measure of the world's livability. When it is low, it means that the world is a place in which the typical individual is acquiring only the barest, cheapest nourishment, has very few resources for keeping safe, and certainly has few resources to spend on fulfilling pursuits. When it is high, it means that the world is a place in which the typical individual has the resources to stay nourished and safe, as well as to pursue opportunities for fulfillment. This includes ample, healthy, tasty food, comfortable homes, protection from the elements, time to spend with friends and loved ones, entertainment, and opportunities to enjoy nature. And population is an excellent measure of the world's livability because it measures how many people the world can support at a given life expectancy and income. When population, life expectancy and income are high, that means the world is a place in which billions of people's efforts are able to lead them to successfully acquire ample nourishment and safety, as well as to pursue opportunities for fulfillment. If today's narrative about fossil fuels destroying our delicate, nurturing planet were true, then a chart of fossil fuel use, life expectancy, income, and population would be a sad story. As fossil fuel use went up, life expectancy would go down as fossil fuels depleted the Earth of nourishment and created myriad new dangers. Income would also go down as resources became scarce, and the scarcity would become worse and worse if population went up. But when we look at an actual chart of these metrics of a livable world, we see that these metrics are all going up in an unbelievable hockey stick pattern that exactly correlates with fossil fuel use, including the CO2 emissions that are supposedly destroying our world. I call this chart the hydrocarbons and human flourishing hockey sticks, hydrocarbons being the more technical and accurate name for fossil fuels. As I'll discuss in Chapter 5, fossil fuels are essentially combinations of hydrogen and carbon atoms derived from ancient life. One of the key phenomena this chart shows is that each of the metrics of livability, life expectancy, income, population, stagnated at a very low level for thousands of years, meaning Earth was a barely livable place from a human flourishing perspective. While these charts go back only 2,000 years, we know from historical records that they were preceded by tens of thousands of years of even less flourishing and progress. Then, some 200 years ago, everything started improving dramatically. Earth went from what we would consider an unlivable place for the average human being to an increasingly livable place, continuing through to today, with the world being what our ancestors would consider to be an unimaginably livable place. The incredible improvement in Earth's livability should be the number one story we talk about when we talk about our relationship to our environment. It should be the subject of fascination, enthusiasm, and aspiration, the aspiration to continue our overall positive direction. Instead, the incredible improvement in Earth's livability is the subject of disinterest and evasion by our knowledge system, to the point that most people think that Earth today is a less livable place than it used to be, as reflected in the survey I shared earlier. How can it be that today's planet, when it is far more conducive to human flourishing than it has ever been, is regarded as the least livable planet in human history? For those ignorant of the data, the anti-impact framework's delicate nurturer assumption explains a lot. We are taught constantly that a natural, unimpacted planet is the best possible planet for all species, including ours. So we assume that if we're having a lot of impact, which fossil fuel use certainly does, it must be self-destructive and life must be getting worse. But for those familiar with the data, including most designated experts, the answer is the anti-impact framework's goal and standard of eliminating human impact. Our knowledge system, especially its designated experts, operating on the anti-impact framework, teaches us to evaluate the livability of the planet, not in terms of how livable it actually is for human beings, but in terms of how little impact we've made. Thus, as I discussed in Chapter 3, even though Earth is more livable than ever, it's widely evaluated as destroyed, because we've impacted it so much, even though that impact has brought billions of people out of poverty and made them far safer from climate danger. Note that most people don't even think of the state of poverty when they think of the livability of the planet. That's how anti-human a perspective the anti-impact framework and its vague environmental terminology give us. If we are to gain a proper understanding of the role of fossil fuels or anything else in human flourishing, we must reject the anti-impact framework totally, including its negative evaluation of the state of today's world. And we must eagerly seek to understand the causes of today's unprecedented livability especially its most fundamental causes. This is especially true because billions of people on this planet still have life expectancies and/or incomes that make Earth far less livable for them than it is for those of us in the prosperous world. Which brings us to the final hockey stick, CO2. The popular narrative is that rising CO2 levels make the planet increasingly unlivable. If a hockey stick increase of rising CO2 levels corresponded to no decline in the world's livability, that alone would raise serious questions about the dangers of rising CO2 levels. But the hydrocarbons and human flourishing hockey sticks illustrate that the incredible increase in the world's livability correlates directly with a rapid increase in human CO2 emissions. What to make of this? The hydrocarbons and human flourishing hockey sticks, at minimum, demonstrate that whatever negative impacts rising CO2 may have on the livability of our world via additional climate danger, those negatives have been completely overwhelmed by other factors. Factors that, for example, have saved and extended billions of lives that would have, in the past, been lost to starvation, poverty, and disease. But we know from Chapter 2 that rising CO2 emissions haven't even negatively impacted the livability of our world via additional climate danger, because climate-related disaster deaths are at an all-time low. Thus, rising CO2 emissions directly correlate with the world becoming far more livable across the board, including climate becoming far more livable. While an incredibly strong direct correlation between CO2 emissions and the world's livability doesn't prove causation, such correlations are often reflections of causation. And in this case, the relationship is causal to a degree that almost no one appreciates. The ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy emitting the CO2 is literally driving the world's unprecedented increasing livability. I want to distinguish my view from the position that fossil fuel energy is incidental to, or even merely important to, the unprecedented and growing livability of our world. When the improvement of our world is, all too rarely and incompletely, acknowledged, it is invariably ascribed to crucial factors that are treated as unrelated or barely related to fossil fuel use, such as scientific discoveries, technological innovation, improved medical care, and improved sanitation. While scientific discoveries, technological innovations, improved medical care, and improved sanitation are indeed crucial contributors to the world's livability, they are not unrelated or barely related to fossil fuel use. In fact, they have overwhelmingly depended on and will continue to depend on ultra-cost-effective energy production from fossil fuels or their equal. Thus, my claim about the current benefits of fossil fuels is radical in two respects. I am claiming, one, that today's world is unnaturally livable, not, as our knowledge system portrays, unnaturally unlivable, and two, that the role of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy is not incidental or even just important, it is fundamental. The problem of human weakness on a naturally deficient and dangerous planet. To understand what drives the unprecedented and increasing livability of our world today, it's crucial to understand what has prevented the world from being very livable for the typical individual for most of its history. As the hydrocarbons and human flourishing hockey sticks clearly show, for most of the world's history, it was barely livable, with low and nearly stagnant life expectancy and resources for the average individual. Two fundamental causes of the world's low livability throughout its history are, one, the natural unimpacted state of the planet is not conducive to human flourishing, and two, the natural state of human ability is not conducive to human flourishing. I'll start with the natural unimpacted state of the planet. Today we are taught by our anti-impact knowledge system, which operates on the delicate nurturer assumption, to regard Earth as naturally stable, sufficient, and safe, so long as we don't impact it too much. But this is refuted by the entirety of human history, as well as the significant poverty that still exists in many parts of the world. The unimpacted Earth is not a delicate nurturer, it is only wild potential. It has all the building blocks of life, such as water, carbon, and an atmosphere with oxygen. It has ample raw materials, such as metals, rocks, and sand. It has many beautiful places, such as beaches, mountains, rivers. But in the Earth's unimpacted state, the potential of these building blocks of life to promote human flourishing is largely unactualized. Every environment on Earth, if not significantly impacted by human beings, is, from a human flourishing perspective, deficient and dangerous. The unimpacted Earth is deficient because it does not automatically produce most of the nourishment, food and water, our bodies need to survive and flourish. And the unimpacted Earth is dangerous because it does automatically produce many threats to our survival, above all predators, large and small, and climate. Unless human beings act to overcome the problem of the naturally deficient and dangerous state of Earth, it is impossible for the average person to flourish. The key to overcoming this problem is producing values that will nourish us, protect us from nature's dangers, and provide opportunity for fulfillment. From abundant food and clean water, to shelter and medical care, to education and entertainment. Thus, a timeless but little recognized truth is that the livability of our naturally deficient and dangerous world is overwhelmingly determined by humanity's productive ability. Our productive ability is the amount of life-enhancing value we can produce in a given amount of time. I emphasize in a given amount of time because producing value takes time, and human time continuously consumes value, including food, water, and fuel for warmth. The less value we can produce in a given amount of time, the lower our ability to flourish or even to survive. For example, throughout history, when subsistence farmers have consumed food or firewood faster than they could produce them, they ran out of resources and died. The greater the value we can produce in a given amount of time, the greater our ability to survive and flourish on this naturally deficient and dangerous planet. For example, modern farmers who can produce hundreds or thousands of times their family's food needs are in a position to trade their surplus food production for abundant food, water, shelter, heating, and other life-enhancing values. To such people, the world is abundant, not because it is naturally so, but because their productive ability, along with the productive ability of countless others, makes it unnaturally abundant. While productive ability is the solution to the problem of a naturally barely livable planet, it is a solution that is naturally out of reach for human beings because of a second problem, the natural physically weak state of humans, which limits our ability to deploy the energy that production requires. Our productive ability, the amount of life-enhancing value we can produce in a given amount of time, is directly linked to the amount of energy we can deploy in a given amount of time. The reason is that all production involves transforming nature, and transforming nature takes energy. When we are producing any material value, from a crop of corn to a water treatment plant to a hospital, we are using energy to transform the elements of nature into a more valuable form. Energy, in the broadest sense, is a measure of physical work, which in physics is defined as the product of force and distance. How much physical force is used over what distance to transform the elements of nature from one form into another form? The more physical work involved in a productive process, the more energy it takes. Building a modern home takes a lot more energy than building a teepee, which takes a lot more energy than just moving oneself into a cave. And here we run into the problem that has plagued human beings throughout history and still plagues billions today. Our productive ability is severely limited by our innate lack of ability to deploy energy, our lack of physical power. Power is the rate at which a person, animal, or machine can do physical work. That is, the rate at which they deploy energy. The more power we have at our disposal, the more food, clothing, shelter, medical care, education, and anything else we can produce with our limited time. Unfortunately, from the perspective of production, our bodies on their own are weak, not sufficiently powerful to produce enough value for the average person to flourish. As deserted island stories accurately portray, left to our own devices, about the best we can do is build a primitive shelter that wouldn't survive a major storm, and if we're lucky, find or grow enough food to keep us going. One way in which human beings throughout history have tried to overcome their lack of power is by producing and using manual tools. Tools where we are the power source. Manual tools give us the ability to do more with the same amount of energy. A world with manual tools is a far more livable world than a world without them. That's why a top priority in deserted island stories is to fashion tools that will make the island more livable. A human being can kill more edible animals with a spear than he can with his bare hands using the same number of calories. A human being with a knife can gather more berries than a human being without one. A human being with a container can acquire more water than a human being without one. Manual tools are amazing, but our ability to use manual tools is limited by the amount of energy we have to produce them and to power them. As much as manual tools help human beings, when human beings can only make and use tools with their own physical power, they can't produce all that many tools, and they can't do all that much with those tools. Hence, even in places historically and today, where human beings have had advanced tool-making abilities, the average person cannot produce enough to flourish. For example, even in the wealthiest parts of the world, in Europe, several hundred years ago, where human beings had extremely advanced manual tool-making abilities, the average person was desperately poor. Thus, there is no getting around the fact that when human beings must produce largely using their weak physical bodies, the typical human being must spend enormous amounts of time to survive at a crude, insecure level. Not only is this miserable in and of itself, but it also inhibits the very thing that could make life better: time for productive innovation. A major driver of progress is innovation, identifying and implementing new, better forms of production, such as a better product, or a better method of producing it, or a better tool, or, as I will emphasize in this book, a better machine. Innovation takes time. Time to learn enough to have new ideas, time to think of new ideas, and time to implement new ideas. But manual labor, low productivity life, which is in desperate need of productive innovation, also lacks the time necessary for such innovation. This explains much of the flatness of the human flourishing hockey sticks. When productivity and therefore income are low, life expectancy is low, and time for innovation is limited, which keeps productivity low, which keeps time for innovation low, and so on. I call this the vicious circle of unempowerment, because human beings' lack of power, unempowerment, makes them barely productive in the first place, which gives them little time and resources to figure out how to become more productive, which keeps them barely productive, and so on. Understanding the two natural obstacles to a livable world, the naturally deficient and dangerous nature of this planet, and our natural physical weakness, explains the flat part of the hydrocarbons in human flourishing hockey sticks. Human beings relying on their own meager productive energy cannot produce enough value to flourish and progress on this naturally deficient and dangerous planet. Fossil fuels have increasingly solved the problem of human weakness on this naturally deficient and dangerous planet by producing energy cost-effectively enough that human beings can use machines to produce the values that we need to survive and flourish. The solution: cost-effective machine labor and machine food. The key to transforming this naturally deficient and dangerous planet into a livable world is for human beings to overcome their natural weakness by using machines, tools that are largely powered not by highly limited human energy, but by potentially unlimited external, non-human sources of energy. As I discussed in Chapter 1, machines amplify and expand our productive abilities, our ability to produce the values we need to survive and flourish, from food to clothing to shelter to medical care to education. Amplify. Machines amplify our productive abilities by enabling us to produce far more value in less time. For example, a modern combine harvester can reap and thresh enough wheat to make 500,000 loaves of bread in a day, about 1,000 times what a highly capable human can. Expand. Machines also expand our productive abilities by producing types of value that no number of humans can produce without machines. For example, an incubator can produce a perfect environment for a premature baby in a way that no amount of manual labor can. An airplane can produce a form of high-speed safe travel that no amount of manual labor can. The computing machines of the internet produce near-instantaneous and unlimited access to knowledge, making unprecedented educational opportunities accessible to billions, something no amount of manual labor can do. The more we can use machine labor instead of human labor, the greater our ability to produce values that nourish, protect, and fulfill us. So why don't human beings just use machine labor for everything? Because the amount of machine labor human beings can use is limited by the cost-effectiveness of machine labor, including, crucially, the cost-effectiveness of the energy, machine food, needed to power all machine labor. The essence of cost-effectiveness is how much value something produces compared with how much value it consumes. For example, cost-effective employees for a business are those who generate more revenue than it costs to pay them. That is, they produce more value for the business than they consume. And cost-effective machine labor is machine labor that produces more value than it consumes. When we think about machine labor, we always need to recognize that machines not only produce value for us, but also consume value from us, the value involved in building, running, and maintaining the machines. Above all, we need to recognize how much human time machine labor consumes, because time is our most finite and precious value. The main obstacle to using machine labor is lack of cost-effectiveness, machine labor consuming more value than it produces. I call this the private jet problem. Travel by private jet is an amazing thing. If you have a private jet, you can save a lot of time in your traveling, and you can travel to all kinds of great places at the drop of a hat. So why don't the vast majority of us travel by private jet? Because despite the value of the time private jet labor produces, the enormous amount of resources consumed via private jet labor makes it cost prohibitive for the vast majority of us. These resources include the large amounts of fuel private jets run on, all the resources needed to mine the raw materials for the plane, all the resources needed to manufacture the plane's parts, all the resources needed to assemble the plane, the time of the pilot who flies the plane, the time and resources involved in maintaining and operating airports, and so on. The enormous amount of resources involved in private jet labor is why a 5-hour cross-country flight on a private jet can cost $50,000. Let's say the private jet trip saves 2 hours of time at the airport. For the rare CEO who can produce way more than $50,000 of value in those 2 hours, such as Tim Cook of Apple, it's worth it. But someone making $25 an hour would need to work 2,000 hours, an average work year, to save 2 hours via private jet. For such a person, producing private jet machine labor consumes far, far more value than it produces. Throughout human history, most machine labor for most people has been like a private jet. Wonderful if they could afford it, but completely cost ineffective. The key to solving the private jet problem, the cost ineffectiveness of machine labor, is to make the most significant input of machine labor, energy, more cost effective. the cost effectiveness of energy plays much more of a role in the cost effectiveness of machine labor than you might think. Of course, once you grasp that machines run on energy, it becomes clear that the cost of machine labor includes the cost of the energy needed to power a given machine. For example, the cost of automobile labor includes the cost of gasoline to power the automobile. The cost of washing machine labor includes the cost of the electricity to power the washing machine, and the cost of smartphone labor includes the cost of the electricity to power the smartphone. But the energy that powers a machine is only the beginning of the energy it uses. Any machine we use doesn't just use energy in its operation, it also has used the energy that operated the hundreds or even thousands of other machines that produced it. Take a smartphone. It's easy to think of a smartphone as a low-energy machine because it takes relatively little electricity to charge. But there is an enormous amount of unseen machine labor used in producing a smartphone, all of which factors into its cost. Think of all the raw materials in a smartphone, such as aluminum, lithium, carbon, iron, silicon, copper, cobalt, and nickel. Every one of these is mined using some mining machine. Then all the mined materials need to be refined and processed using machines into usable components. Then those components need to be manufactured using machines into smartphones. And at every stage of production, transportation machines are needed to get materials, components, or finished smartphones from where they are to where they need to be. All the aforementioned machines use energy, and the cost of all their energy goes into the cost of a smartphone. But that's just the beginning, because all the aforementioned machines were themselves produced using hundreds of machines, and the cost of all that energy goes into smartphones too. And on top of that, the operation of a smartphone as a communication device draws on myriad massive machines, computers and data centers around the world. While smartphone charging is typically a small fraction of your household energy use, the streaming of data over the internet infrastructure can use significantly more energy that we aren't taught to think about. Once we understand that the cost of machine labor is driven by the cost of powering a given machine, plus the often far greater costs of powering all the other machines involved in producing that machine, we can see why the cost effectiveness of energy production, how affordable, reliable, versatile, and scalable it is fundamental to the cost effectiveness of machine labor. And as we have seen, the cost effectiveness of machine labor is fundamental to humanity's productive ability, which is fundamental to the world's livability. Thus, the cost effectiveness of energy is not, as our knowledge system communicates, trivial to the livability of our world. It is fundamental to the world's livability in any era because it determines the extent of naturally weak human beings' ability to use machines to produce the values they need to flourish on this naturally deficient and dangerous planet. Which is why fossil fuels, by providing a uniquely cost-effective form of energy for the last 200 or so years, have been and remain fundamental to the unprecedented and increasing productive ability and therefore livability of our world. Humanity's unprecedented fossil-fueled productivity and progress. As the hydrocarbons in human flourishing hockey stick's income hockey stick captures, humanity's productive ability is higher than it has ever been. Specifically, humanity today has the ability to produce an unprecedented quantity of values, such as food, shelter, and clothing, and an unprecedented variety of values, from airplane trips to Google searches to MRI scans, with our always limited time. And humanity's productive ability is not only unprecedented in its current state, it is unprecedented in its rate of progress, which took off like a hockey stick, not coincidentally, around the time when humanity started using fossil fuels. Ultra-cost-effective energy from fossil fuels drives this unprecedented, increasing productive ability in two basic, inextricably intertwined ways. One, through powering ultra-cost-effective machine labor, and two, through the enormous amounts of human mental labor freed up by ultra-cost-effective machine labor. Powering ultra-cost-effective machine labor. As I briefly documented in Chapter 1, and will explain in more detail in the next chapter, fossil fuels today provide a uniquely cost-effective form of energy, one that is low cost, on demand, versatile, and available on a global scale to billions of people and thousands of places. The ultra-cost-effectiveness of fossil fuel energy makes machine labor so cost-effective that it can be used everywhere in every aspect of life. Recall the private jet problem, where despite being highly desirable, machine labor is not cost-effective for most people because it consumes more value, above all human time, than it produces. Fossil fuels have made machine labor so cost-effective for billions of people that a private jet is one of the few machines that is not cost-effective in the empowered world. The vast majority of machines, from washing machines to smartphones to refrigerators to air conditioners, are cost-effective for billions of people. Recognizing that fossil-fueled machines empower us to produce incomparably more value in less time is crucial to understanding fossil fuels' fundamental role in our productive ability, but it is only the beginning. Enormous amounts of human mental labor freed up by ultra-cost-effective machine labor. Recall the vicious circle of unempowerment. When human beings must produce, largely using their own energy, the average human being must spend enormous amounts of time to survive at a crude, insecure level, which means very little time to produce values other than their barest survival needs. But with today's fossil-fueled machine labor, humans can produce enough for their barest survival needs very quickly. This means they have abundant freed-up time to engage in the human mental labor, work that involves the unique abilities, including creative abilities, of the human mind, that most modern productive areas require. This includes scientific research, technological development, medical care, and sanitation, the things that supposedly have nothing to do with fossil fuels. Fossil fuel freed up mental labor, combined with fossil fueled machine labor, makes possible two of the most wonderful aspects of today's productive ability: its super specialization and its rapid innovation. Super specialization. Specialization is the phenomenon of individuals, groups of individuals, and areas of the world focusing on the types of productive work they do best. The more specialized production is, the more productive everyone is overall. A classic example of specialization was Henry Ford's assembly line, where automobiles could be produced much more quickly when each individual focused on a narrow part of the automobile building process rather than engaging in most or all of the building process themselves. Specialization is so powerful that every economic school of thought recognizes it as a fundamental productive benefit. What is rarely recognized is that fossil fuels make possible today's super specialization by freeing up human mental labor, by empowering specialists with machine labor, and by producing ultra-cost-effective transportation that facilitates global trade. Freeing up human mental labor. Without all the time fossil-fueled machine labor frees up from manual labor to meet the most basic survival needs, the human time for all of today's amazing specializations, from medicine to sanitation to entertainment, wouldn't exist. Empowering specialists with machine labor. Every profession today, from doctor to sanitation worker to entertainer, uses machine labor directly and indirectly, making them incomparably more productive than they would otherwise be. For example, entertainers use machine labor to record and broadcast their performances, and machine labor is used to produce every stage, movie set, and other piece of infrastructure entertainers use. Producing ultra-cost-effective transportation that facilitates global trade. Specialization works only to the extent that specialized producers can trade with one another. Trade requires transportation, to move raw materials, components, and finished products from where they are to where they are needed. The more cost-effective transportation is, the more and farther we can trade. Today's global super specialization, which enables us to benefit from the best producers around the world, is made possible by ultra-cost-effective transportation in giant cargo ships, trains, trucks, and planes, almost all powered by low-cost, ultra-concentrated, highly stable oil fuels. Rapid innovation. Fossil-fueled machine labor, including the human mental labor it frees up, is the root of today's massive innovation. Recall that with the vicious circle of unempowerment, the circle involved low productive ability being miserable in and of itself, but also inhibiting the very thing that could make life better: time for productive innovation. Ultra-cost-effective fossil-fueled machine labor drives a wholly different phenomenon, a virtuous circle of empowerment. Fossil-fueled machine labor frees up time that we can devote specifically to productive innovation that utilizes fossil-fueled machines. For example, consider scientific and technological research, fields that are rightly regarded as major drivers of prosperity and progress. It is only in an empowered world, where machine labor does enormous amounts of work for us, that we can confidently free up enormous amounts of human time for such pursuits. And those fields use enormous amounts of machine labor, most directly, high-powered computing machines. The fossil-fueled virtuous circle of empowerment explains why our productive ability is not only unprecedented, but ever-increasing. Human beings are leveraging the time freed up by ultra-cost-effective machine labor to think about how to become even more productive, including how to produce even more cost-effective machine labor. Fossil fuel materials. There is one final way in which fossil fuels amplify our productive ability that needs to be highlighted to fully understand their benefit. It is their use as materials. We live in a world of extremely versatile materials that give us amazing abilities. We have roofing materials that protect us from rain, tires made of materials that can endure tens of thousands of miles, insulation materials that keep us cool in the summer and warm in the winter, and medical materials that enable an artificial limb or even heart to be part of our body. Where do those materials come from? In thousands of cases, they are made wholly or partially using hydrocarbons, aka fossil fuels, mostly oil or natural gas. For simplicity's sake, I'll refer to things being made of oil as a shorthand for oil and/or natural gas. This state of affairs came about because fossil fuels, by fueling super specialization and rapid innovation, led to research and development not just in how to burn fossil fuels for energy, but also in how to leverage their unique properties to make materials. As a result, we have radically different and better materials than our ancestors had. Today's chemical engineers can break down the hydrocarbon molecules of oil into small parts and then reassemble them into an unbelievable variety of polymers, including modern plastics. While you think of the oil in your car as being in the gas tank, in fact, there is more oil in the materials of the car than in the gas tank. The rubber tires are made of oil, the paint and waterproofing are made of oil, the plastic dent-resistant bumper is made of oil, the stuffing inside the seats is made of oil, and in most cars, the entire interior is one oil-based fabric or synthetic material after another, because oil is an amazingly cost-effective material to make things with. You are probably sitting in a room with at least 50 things derived from oil, from the insulation in your walls, to the carpet under your feet, to the laminate on your table, to the screen on your computer. The world around us is made of oil and natural gas and would look completely different without them. It's no exaggeration to say that today's productive ability is fossil-fueled. It depends on ultra-cost-effective fossil-fueled machine labor, fossil fuel freed up time, and fossil fuel materials. Now that we understand that the livability of our world is determined by our productive ability, and that today's productive ability is fundamentally the product of fossil fuels, we are finally in a position to understand, in detail, the full benefits we get from fossil fuels. The benefits that our knowledge system dismisses as trivial to the livability of our world, but are actually fundamental to its unnatural and increasing level of nourishment, safety, and opportunity for fulfillment. An unnaturally nourishing world. How nourishing is today's world, and what is fossil fuels' positive role? This is vital knowledge to have when we are considering negative side effects of fossil fuels to the world's nourishment going forward. While we are taught by our knowledge system, on the delicate nurturer assumption, to think of nourishment as something that our planet naturally provided until it was destroyed by fossil fuels, which supposedly disrupt the naturally favorable weather patterns that our food requires and contaminate the supposedly naturally clean state of water, the reality is that fossil fuels have made a naturally non-nourishing planet unnaturally nourishing. Nature is not a Garden of Eden, in which all the food we need is available to be effortlessly plucked. While certain environments, left to their own devices, might grow some useful fruit trees, no environment, let alone the average environment around the world, left to its own devices, produces abundant healthy food for millions of people or more. Because nature doesn't automatically produce the food we need to survive and flourish, an overwhelming percentage of our food must be produced by us. And food production requires a lot of work, a lot of energy, to transform soil, seeds, water, and animals into nourishing food. In unempowered, largely manual labor environments, the average human being is so limited in their ability to do this kind of productive work that a large percentage of their life must be spent acquiring even crude nourishment. History provides the clearest illustration of how non-nourishing the natural environment is, as today, even the unempowered world benefits from enormous food aid assistance made possible by the machines of the empowered world. As recently as the 1800s, in England, up to 80% of the average family's income, which means 80% of their productive time, went to food, mostly low-quality bread. The result of a life consumed with food production was often what we would consider malnourishment, with frequent famines that made things worse. This was true even in the wealthiest part of the world, Europe. As economic historian Carlo Cipolla wrote, "It is difficult for those living in the industrialized countries of the 20th century to imagine hunger and famine, but pre-industrial Europe resembled 19th century India more than it did 19th century Europe. People literally died of hunger. In the cities, it was not unusual to find men dead in the streets or under the portals. In the countryside, they were found at the roadside, their mouths full of grass and their teeth sunk in the earth. Trying to fend off starvation by eating grass, that's a natural life." There are still billions around the world, the unempowered parts of the world, who live in a largely natural and therefore non-nourishing food environment. While today's unempowered have a more secure food supply than the unempowered world of the past, substantially due to the availability of food relief from the empowered world, their situation is still terrible by the standards of the empowered world because they are largely using manual labor instead of machine labor. In places like Uganda, Zimbabwe, Nepal, Ethiopia, and Niger, more than 2 out of 3 people are farmers. A report on Zambia reports that the average poor rural family here spends 80% of income on food. And in Burundi, more than 9 out of 10 work in agriculture. For these unempowered people, the world is not a nourishing place whatsoever. What about drinking water? While natural water is glorified by advertising today, the reality is that most environments are naturally deficient in drinking water. Drinking water for most people at most times has been naturally dirty and/or distant. Clean drinking water, like virtually every other value, must be produced. When human beings are unempowered, the work that goes into acquiring water of questionable cleanliness is something that takes many hours a week or even a day, with the result being water that is not safe or healthy by empowered standards, often full of dangerous microorganisms. So much for the idea that natural environments nourish us with healthy food and drinking water, and therefore that if we rapidly eliminate fossil fuels, we can be sure that nature will take care of us in the food and water department. By contrast, in today's empowered world, we can spend a small percentage of our time to acquire food and water with unprecedented levels of quality. Consider how much time it takes those of us in the empowered world to meet our basic food needs if we really want to economize. I inadvertently discovered this in college when, after exhausting my meal plan and not wanting to ask my parents for money, I lived on lentils and canned tuna for about $25 a week. A week's worth of food available in as much time as it takes someone to make $25. Thus, someone whose wage is $25 per hour, well below average in the U.S., needs to spend only 1 hour a week, or 9 minutes a day, acquiring food. And for just a little more money, someone today can eat with a healthiness that would have been virtually impossible for almost anyone in the past. To be sure, there are serious concerns about the food choices many people in the empowered world make. But there has never been more opportunity for any of us to have healthy, tasty, convenient, rewarding experiences with food. What about water? Tap water, which with few exceptions is perfectly healthy and far healthier than most natural water historically or today, is about 0.5 cents per gallon. This means that a worker drinking 1 gallon a day works less than a second to acquire it. This is nothing short of magical. What's the source of our magical ability to acquire food and water? Above all, the magic of machines, mostly fossil-fueled, that empower a relative handful of individuals to produce far more and better food and water than entire populations can produce via manual labor. Today's food and water industries employ a massive staff of machine laborers, including cultivation machines, largely powered by oil, the fuel of mobility, that enable workers to do hundreds of times more cultivation of land than humans can via manual labor, like the modern combine harvester, with which one person can reap and thresh enough wheat in a day for 500,000 loaves of bread. Irrigation machines that move optimal amounts of water to where they are needed, regardless of what's naturally happening with rainfall. Irrigated lands average more than 3 times the crop yields of rain-fed areas. Transportation machines that enable all the best cropland in the world to be connected into one giant network, the ultimate food network. Refrigeration machines that preserve food in an optimal state for far longer, whether transporting it or storing it at home. Computing machines that help food producers identify and implement best practices, such as the best ways to plant seeds in different conditions, the optimal amount of water, the optimal amount of fertilizer, etc. Fossil-fueled machine laborers are also the unsung heroes behind ultra-affordable clean drinking water. Purification machines that enable us to transform naturally dirty water or human-contaminated water into clean, healthy drinking water. Pumping machines, like those used in irrigation, that enable us to move drinking water. And the machines I have mentioned so far are just some of the machines involved in food and water production. Every aspect of today's amazing food and water production, from the metal fences used to raise livestock, to the irrigation infrastructure, to the construction of grocery stores, and the office buildings of researchers, is produced by machines, as are all the machines I have mentioned above. And the vast majority of these machines run on fossil fuels because that is by far the most, and sometimes only, cost-effective solution. Whenever we are thinking about the world's ability to provide food and water in the future, we need to recognize that the amazing level of nourishment today's empowered world experiences is the unnatural product of fossil-fueled machine laborers, and that eliminating fossil fuels without a genuinely cost-effective replacement would cause mass starvation. Fossil fuels also free up the time for mental labor that makes possible today's level of food specialization and food innovation. Today's highly specialized food industry is focused not just on food survival, but on food flourishing, producing and enjoying food to its highest potential. For example, today's agriculture includes a significant industry just for mangoes, my favorite fruit, with transportation and refrigeration machines that make possible such miracles as enjoying mangoes in Vermont in the winter. This is a major difference from the agriculture of the past. Almost everyone who works in food, beyond the crudest, cheapest necessities, is able to do so because of the time that fossil-fueled machines have freed up for human beings to specialize in a wide variety of productive pursuits. Fossil fuel freed up time, empowered by fossil-fueled machine labor, makes possible a whole innovative sub-industry of agricultural research, where individuals devote their whole careers to studying how to grow more and healthier food. Chief among such individuals is Norman Borlaug, the leader of the Green Revolution, not related to the modern green movement, whose work in genetics and plant breeding has been credited with preventing upwards of a billion deaths from hunger and malnutrition. Thanks to fossil fuels, Borlaug could live a life of ultra-productive mental labor instead of being yet another one of history's subsistence manual laborers. Finally, today's amazing food production also depends on the many fossil fuel materials involved in modern nourishment, above all, fertilizer. Fertilization increases the amount of crops that can be grown per unit of farmland by increasing the amount of nitrogen plants can absorb and thus the amount they can grow. While there are natural fertilizers, such as bat guano, they do not naturally exist in nearly large enough quantities to fertilize crops for billions. The decline of these fertilizers, even with the late 1800s population of 1.5 billion, led eminent chemist William Crookes to declare in 1898 that all civilizations stand in deadly peril of not having enough to eat. Today we have no such peril because using the Haber-Bosch process, we can transform natural gas into fertilizer. Fertilizer is one of many vital fossil fuel materials in food production. Fossil fuels are the basis of the plastics that keep refrigerators sanitary, containers that keep food fresh longer, and the lubricants that keep machines running. To summarize, fossil fuels provide the ultra-cost-effective machine labor, time, and materials that make the world amazingly, unnaturally nourishing for billions of people. Able to acquire more and more nourishing food and water with smaller and smaller fractions of their time. Without fossil fuels or their equivalent, food production would collapse, and today's unnaturally large population could not possibly survive. With more fossil fuels or their equivalent, billions more people can have the opportunity to acquire the nourishment they need in small amounts of time, instead of devoting huge portions of their lives to procuring mediocre nourishment. That's how fundamental the world's use of fossil fuels is to how unnaturally nourishing it is. The unnaturally nourishing state of today's world for billions of people, its dependence on the uniquely cost-effective energy fossil fuels provide, the opportunity for the planet to become far more nourishing with more fossil fuel use, and the catastrophe of the planet becoming far less nourishing if fossil fuel use is heavily restricted without a true replacement, are crucial context for decision-making about fossil fuels. And yet all of this context is either ignored or outright denied by our knowledge system, to the point that there is no widespread fear whatsoever of what restricting or eliminating fossil fuel use would do to the food and water supply that depends on it. If we were to make even remotely rational decisions about energy going forward, the reality of today's unnatural level of nourishment and its dependence on fossil fuels needs to be widely understood. The world's massive use of fossil fuels is equally fundamental to an aspect of its livability that is even less acknowledged than today's unprecedented nourishment. Its unprecedented safety.